Now open the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Today's March 17th, 2009. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2211. I'm going to call up Katie Koba, Janet Fultz. And Terry, why don't you go ahead and join us. Terry Witt, and this is the extent of our list. We're working on official confirmation that there's no revenue impact, even though we all know there isn't. We're waiting for that to see about a work session maybe later on in the morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. Happy St. Patrick's Day for you Irish people. Somewhere in my family we think there's Irish. Two very exciting bills for you this morning from the Department of Agriculture. The first one, House Bill 2211, is basically a cleanup of our fertilizer statutes. There was a major rewrite of our fertilizer statutes in the 2001 legislative session, and since then the department has proceeded with its authorities under regulation of fertilizer, and after spending a few years with these statutes, have come in with some cleanup language. So there should be nothing major in here, no major policy change issue type things, and hopefully no one that has problems with them. At least if there is, we're not aware of that. One of the biggest issues that came up is the need to have a definition of distribution in the statute, so you can see that that is added in House Bill 2211. Clarify conditions for imposing a maximum civil penalty, clarifying the definition of an agricultural amendment, on and on and on. There is one amendment that we brought forward. We caught an error in House Bill 2211, and so there's a dash one amendment, which you can see actually on the very first page of the bill, line 11, the dash one amendment removes the phrase intended as a source of plant food. And, Mr. Chair, we can certainly go through section by section if you want, or if you want, I can't imagine, it's just really not that exciting, but I'd like to try to make it that way. I'm sure Representative Gilliam could find something very exciting about this bill. But we're certainly willing to answer any questions the committee may have.
He wants a shovel.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Gilliam.
I'm certainly glad that you brought attention to me on this. And thank you so much for being here as well. Actually, on line 11, the phrase is broken and goes on to line 12.
Right.
Thank you, Mr.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Representative Shoffler.
There's a lot going on in here, a lot of words. I read it this morning, and I've talked to really nice people, have assured me everything's fine, and now we have you, Madam Director, here. At the subpoena power and the entry of land, you want to just kind of expand on that a little bit? It always makes me a little skittish when we're talking about stepping onto somebody else's land. So just want to let me know what we're doing here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, I think at this point in time it would be very appropriate to turn it over to someone who actually knows more about our fertilizer program than I do, Janet Fultz. And Janet, you can introduce yourself and then take a stab at it.
For the record, I'm Janet Fultz. I'm the program manager for the fertilizer program in the Department of Agriculture. Chair Clem, Representative Shoffler. In response to your question, the portion that you're talking about was recommended to us by our Assistant Attorney General to add, to clarify our authority. The authority to do inspections, entry onto property, take samples, take records if we need so, has already been established. It was the addition of a warrant and subpoena authority that she wanted to make sure was clear to the public in the statute. And that's why the Assistant Attorney General recommended those changes.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Chair. And then I think there's language in there that says, as as many times as reasonable or something like that.
At times that are reasonable.
Can you tell me, in what's our history here? How frequently do you find yourself having to go back, and how often would you go back?
Okay.
How often do we do this, I guess, is even a better question.
The situation for inspections is, in a good situation, we would be able to get to a facility maybe once every 2 years. If there's cause for inspection, if there is a complaint, then we can go. I think when they say at reasonable times, they're talking about times during the day when a business is open.
Oh, okay.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, just kind of for your information in terms of philosophy, obviously, if we get to the point where we're having, in any of our programs, to issue a subpoena or a warrant, that's not a good situation. And clearly for us, we want to avoid getting to that point at all costs. And I cannot remember in my tenure as director, which began in 2003, that the department has had to issue a warrant. We've had, I'm trying to remember if we had to issue any subpoenas.
Not in the fertilizer program.
In the pesticide program with our recent inspection, possibly in Mount Hare County, but it's pretty rare for us.
All right, thank you.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 9, section 25, on receipt of a fee, and it used to be $5, established by the State Department of Agriculture. You just establish a fee. What is the fee? Is it $5 now and you're going to change it to something?
Page 9.
Yeah, section 25.
I'm not finding section 25. Do you have a line number?
Is it 22, line 22?
Okay, I see what I've done. I've got the one amendment under the other bill. Thank you.
Okay.
I'll use that on the other one, though.
Say,
get ready for the question.
Krieger, I know how to answer that question in 22-20.
It's coming.
I didn't see that section.
Yeah.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to take just a little side trip. I won't go too far here, Mr. Chair, but I wanted to ask Ms. Fultz a couple of questions, if I could. I'm very excited about another project that we're going to have a presentation on in here later. It's moving hydrogen forward as an alternative energy. And don't think fuel cells and cars. This is combustion and supplementing our power grid. And one of the happy byproducts, I hope, is going to be green ammonia. There's a term for it that I've lost my mind, of course. It starts with an A.
Anhydrous
ammonia. Thank you.
Holy cow.
Well, that's very good. Thank you.
Yeah. See that a lot.
Is that something that you have had contact with or regulate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, the fertilizer program does regulate anhydrous ammonia when it's used as a fertilizer.
And that's the... follow up?
Please.
That's the part I'm excited about because... if you can get energy prices down, you can actually crack the hydrogen out of water. But the great part is you can store it in anhydrous ammonia, which is richer in ammonia hydrogen molecules than liquid hydrogen is. And I just wanted to get your reaction to the fact that this always makes people nervous. Like, I believe right now there's a train somewhere in Salem moving ammonia fertilizer around someplace, probably for farm use. And everybody's a little nervous about this, and I don't think we need to be. In fact, I think this is even safer because we would store it at center of load in rural areas. And part of it we could use to burn the hydrogen cleanly to supplement our grid, and part of it we could use as an agricultural application. I just wanted to get your comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, with anhydrous ammonia, the biggest challenge in the state has been theft of anhydrous for use for methamphetamines. And that's been the biggest challenge to our farmers, especially on the east side. Since there's been a crackdown on a lot of the meth production in the state, the thefts have gone down. But however, the anhydrous ammonia use has become minimal as well. So it's not a product that is being used as much as it used to be because of the dangers and the hazards with people stealing it.
And one last follow-up. This is a little naive. How do they steal it? I mean, do they take a whole tank?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, what they do is they have these big tanks at facilities, and the bad guys come in. Leave it at that. They come in and they actually either puncture the tanks to transfer the material into either small propane tanks they'll load, or other thermos bottles, you name it. And then they, if they don't explode, then they just leave it and it leaks out, causing a huge, huge environmental issue.
One last follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chair. So, well, I'm concerned about that, so we're going to have more security involved with it, I'm sure, if we store it. By the way, are you aware of the party affiliation of those bad guys?
Oh, my God.
But
anarchists.
There you go.
On the positive side of using it, obviously, prices of fertilizer way up, prices of ammonia produced, let's say, in Russia with a carbon footprint because of the way that they make it. Green ammonia, aside from this other theft issue, is a pretty attractive, a fertilizer for Oregon?
Chair Clem, sorry, Representative Gilliam, I think whenever the state is able to produce a product that can be used in the state, there is a benefit all the way around.
Thanks a lot.
So, Representative Shoffler, just before you ask your question, it's and something, not Anheuser. They're trying to regulate it. I just want you to calm down.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Anheuser, and I'm familiar with anhydrous. Matter of fact, in Iowa, is it still used widely as it was when I was a kid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, yes, it is.
But not
Midwest.
Not in Oregon because of the different kind of crops and
different cropping patterns, different availability.
Now, if I may, please. My best man and I was his best man. We grew up together, Brian Laurie, and they actually have these big. They look like a propane tank for a home heating fuel, and they're on wheels, and they drag them behind a tractor, mm-hmm. and then they got a spring out there dragging it in as it applies it, and the connection came loose and was spraying and stuff right in the cab, and he had stopped. We were like 16 years old, and it damn near killed him. But it's very common in Iowa, and you could literally hook right up with your pickup and drag hundreds of gallons of this stuff down the road. And I imagine, if I can think of it, those crazy bustards that are, I don't know what their party affiliation is, but they're probably the same people running the country the last 8 years.
Hey.
All right.
Mr.
Someone's
Chair.
Had too much Anheuser this morning already. Okay, then. Terry, did you want to get in on this?
My name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. And I think to add to Representative Gilliam's question, there has been an increase in anhydrous ammonia used as a refrigerant, particularly as refrigeration systems go away from Freon and the other ozone-depleting types of refrigerant material. So you'll see a lot of food processing plants a lot of times using anhydrous ammonia as a refrigerant in their cooling systems. So, with regard to the bill before us, House Bill 2211, we were part and parcel to the 2001 rewrite of the fertilizer statutes, and actually we've been working for some time now trying to get clarification and minor housekeeping changes to the fertilizer statutes, so we're glad to see this happen. I would just like to bring out one point, and we have discussed it with the department. On line page 16, section 17, lines 24 through 26, there is a single word change basically in there that makes a significant change in the intent of the law, and that is to eliminate the word and replace it with or. And this is for significant violations, civil penalty violations, punishable up to $10,000 per offense. the law used to read that that the violation arises from gross negligence or willful misconduct and that results in substantial harm or human health or to human health or the environment. The and was also a condition that had to be met along with the willful or gross negligence. It is now separated out so that those are standalone conditions. It could be could either be gross negligence or willful misconduct or an action that results in significant or substantial harm to human health or the environment. Initially, I had some concern over that. It all depends on how the department will interpret willful misconduct. And as long as that is indeed for significant circumstances and not just a substitute for the word knowingly, in other words, if somebody makes an omission or falsifies a document that really is rather inconsequential but does it knowingly, that does not put them in harm's way of a $10,000 penalty per day for an extended period of time. And I've been given some assurances by the department that, no, that's not the intent of this. And as the matrix for the civil penalty is played out, gravity of the offense and all of those types of multipliers or details are also looked at when determining what the fine could be or penalty could be. The $10,000 is a maximum. Doesn't say that they have to impose a $10,000. It says they may. And you know, we have been very appreciative of the way civil penalties have been issued, harsh when need to be and lenient when not. Over the course of my dealing with the department over 20 years, we've not seen an abuse of that power. But I just wanted to point that out, that is a significant change. But in some cases, I think something that needs to be in there, if we have somebody that does an act that does cause harm to the environment or human health, that they can, in essence, issue a civil penalty without proving that it was done intentionally. And I think that's the major reason that change was made. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, that completes our witness list. We were unable to get the revenue impact statement back, even though we know there is none. So we're not going to be able to do anything, I don't think, with this today. So I'm just going to close the public hearing and carry close the public hearing on House Bill 2211 and carry it over to Thursday. You two might as well stay, yeah. See what else we got. Yeah. I said we could reopen, but we haven't done anything. We've heard a bill, but we don't have what we need to work it. Okay. Dan, I don't think you were actually wanting to testify on this one, too, were you? This one as well? Okay. So why don't... Let me see how this works. Okay. Is this one of your...
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, okay. Okay. All right, then. Please, I'll rework the deal
here. Thank you.
Here.
Mr. Chair, again, Katie Koba, Department of Agriculture Director, speaking to you on House Bill 2212. This is a bill at first look that looks pretty significant. What the bill does...
Sorry, I need to open a public hearing on House Bill 2212. Thanks, Edward.
Do I need to introduce myself again? For the record, Katie Koba, Director of Department of Agriculture. House Bill 2212 is before you, and this is basically a reorganization and update of all of the department's various statutes that deal with plant quarantine and noxious weed laws. These are things that have been put into statute over the past 50 years. If you go to our statute and try to find something related to plant quarantine or noxious weeds, oftentimes you have to look in multiple places. It is very confusing. And so we are taking this opportunity to basically update, get rid of things that are no longer needed in the statute, and hopefully write the statute in a way that is easier to read and follow. We do have a model in this work, and that is the very exciting, again, National Model Plant Pest Law. There is a National Plant Board, and this is the kind of things they do for a living. And in 2000, they did develop a model state plant law. So we have taken that model and used it in updating our statutes. Dan Hilburn, who is the administrator of our plant division, is here and, again, can go through the bill section by section if that's what you would like, or if you want to just, again, throw it open for questions in places. Could you happen to give them the FAQ sheet?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, you will remember when this bill first came to you, there were some people that came to you with questions, and the department did convene a work group. I think Beth set in on a meeting. So there were a number of constituent groups that had a chance to visit with us about this bill. We do have some proposed amendments, if I'm correct, Dan, as a result of that effort. But, again, we believe now that everyone who has an interest in House Bill 2212 is comfortable with the bill moving forward. So with that, why don't I pause and see if there are questions.
Representative Chopper.
I have one question. I think my friend here has more. The longer we stare at this, I'm sure we'll have increasingly more questions. It talks about incidental damage to property resulting from abatement. We currently do, if necessary, abatement. And is that correct? And if we do, I'd imagine it is. How often or how frequently do you see us in a situation where there could potentially be incidental loss or damage? And I know you're going to avoid that, but it just leaps out of the page at me, because the last thing I want is, or we want, or you want, is someone saying, well, the state came and trampled all over my stuff and wrecked it, and now they're not going to pay for it. Just want to expand on that a little bit. If there's any experience in that, how frequently it happens, or give me an example. Please.
For the record, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm administrator of the Plant Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Chair Clem, Representative Choffler, excellent question. And the answer is a little bit complicated. If you look at our weed laws in particular right now, they're all built on two species, ragweed and tansy ragwort. And those laws were adopted more than 50 years ago. And part of what this bill does is align current programs with the authority. And right now, the authority is for those two weeds. And the program is much different than it was when those two weeds were adopted. So there is an issue with abatement right now. And one of the issues is that our authority is a little shaky unless we're dealing with those two weeds. Now, specifically to address your concern, the provision in the bill is to let people know up front that if we have a weed situation or a quarantine situation that needs to be abated, that there is no automatic compensation from the state. And to give you an example of things that have happened recently, a sudden oak death in nurseries, when we destroy nursery stock, that's too bad. It's a loss to them, which is different than in the animal world in agriculture. But that's reality. We wanted to put it, make it clear that's what reality is.
If I may.
Yes, follow up.
So if we had mad cow disease or some other, there's a bunch of them out there, you had to destroy some livestock. On the abatement, does that just, how do you determine what to abate and not to abate? There's a lot of stuff out there. We could work forever getting rid of invasive species, and we couldn't even do it.
Right.
Where do you draw the line on that? How do you determine that? I mean, mad cow and the sudden oak, those are easy for me to see, but where do you say, okay, this is something we're going to work on?
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, another good question. And we have a state weed board in this state, and one of the tasks of the state weed board is to prioritize the noxious weeds in the state. First of all, they separate the noxious weeds from the nuisance weeds. The garden variety weeds, those aren't noxious weeds. Most of the stuff that you and I pull in our gardens and yard aren't considered noxious weeds. But the weeds like blackberry and Scotch broom, which will compete with native environments, take over riparian habitats, those are the noxious weeds. So the State Board prioritizes the weeds into noxious or not, and then within the noxious weeds, they prioritize them into A weeds, B weeds, and T weeds. And the A weeds are the really bad ones that we don't have and don't want. So kudzu, purple star thistle, Patterson's curse, the things that are not supposed to be in this state. We know they're bad and we want to keep them out. Bee weeds are ones that are widespread. It's too late to get rid of them, but we don't want them to get worse. So we don't allow those to be sold or propagated or imported into the state. So we're trying to keep those from getting worse. So there is a priority system. The abatement would come with A-rated weeds. If somebody had a new weed on their property that the State Weed Board decided was A-rated, we needed to keep it out of the state, and I'll give you an example. Small broom rape in a clover field in Aurora a few years back, we burned that whole crop, clover and all, and that farmer was out one field's worth of clover.
Mr. Chair, follow up. You know, I get rather vocal working in my yards, and I'm going to start using those A weeds, in case my neighbors are listening, rather than using the other labels I apply to them.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, when you say those A weeds, they'll know you're really, really mad.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Then it'll be time to go check out on the Anheuser, not the Anhydrous.
That's it.
Thank you very much. Representative Greer.
He really lives his weeds, doesn't he?
Yeah.
You never know what little knit someone's going to live in. Page 4, Section 13. You added a threat to natural resources, watershed health. Can you talk to us why that's there like it is? I think I understand why. On page 4.
Oh, section 13. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the reason that was added was to bring our weed laws in line with our weed grant program, which receives Measure 66 money, which is for watershed health and habitat restoration.
Yep. I just want to make sure you got it out. And then the other one I talked to you about earlier, you said you had the answer. I guess it's on page 10, section 25. It used to say of a $5 fee and established by, now it says established by the State Department of Agriculture. What will you now be doing with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, and Dan can probably add to this. Most of our fees in statute are a cap. So this is a temporary nursery license fee. So a garden club has a weekend plant sale. They need a temporary nursery license fee from us. It costs us more than $5 to issue that license fee. So we're raising the cap in statute to $50. I don't know if we have set on the actual amount we're going to go
cost
to.
Cost recovery.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, so it's cost recovery. So if it costs us $25 to issue the license, we'll set the fee at $25.
Well, I saw the 50 somewhere else in here.
Right below.
Yeah.
So, follow up, when there you say is. You're changing that in statute, you mean right here or another bill?
Mr. Chair, it would raise the cap in statute for a temporary nursery license fee from the current cap of $5 to a cap of $50. And then in rule, we would clarify. So probably in rule, what we're going to say is cost recovery to issue that license. So it would not exceed $50.
That's no section 25.
Could you clarify where we are, Mr. Chair? I'm sorry.
Yeah, this is page 10. Lines 17, 18, and then 29 through 32. And it shows where it's $5 taken out, and it just says receipt of a fee established, then down below it says they shall establish the fee described up above by rule.
I think he's working off of a hand in gross.
And it shall be sufficient to cover the costs, but not more than $50. So it's a fee cap removal with a possible fee increase coming by rule.
That's a large increase potential. However, because you're going to do it by rule, it might say $15, it might say $20. And I guess in this case, it depends the confidence, whether we have confidence in your agency to use good judgment, common sense. I don't think that you've broke that faith with us in the past, so I wouldn't object to the way it's...
No. Does someone have a cell phone, maybe?
Not me.
Not me.
I don't have mine.
Well, we'll find out.
It's electricity emanating from his interest in weeds.
In weeds. Okay. Terry, do you want to provide some testimony?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Terry Witt with the Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We support the bill, and as the director had commented, there were a number of people that got involved in drafting what are the Dash 1 amendments to the bill. I don't know if those have been distributed to the committee or not, but we are in support of the Dash 1 amendments. There were a number of issues that were worked out between some environmental organizations and Dan Hilbert and ourselves, and I think the Dash 1 amendments actually make the House Bill 2212 a better bill. Specifically, outlines on page 4 very specifically what is meant by, in essence, an integrated weed management approach to the controlling noxious weeds, and I think everyone is comfortable with the fact that it really does focus on early detection, identification, and from our perspective notes that rapid response and eradication are two of the techniques that are very critical to proper invasive weed control, as Mr. Hilburn noted. Some of these newly invasive species are potentially problematic. I know things like having visited some weed problems back in the East in a previous job. Plants like kudzu are extremely difficult to eradicate once they get started. They're very prolific. They grow up telephone poles, across wires, and you can. It's almost like bamboo. You can watch them grow. They're that prolific. So that's one of the weeds that Dan had mentioned, that if we find it, it's you jump on it and you eradicate it. You don't just try to control it. You kill it. So with that, I'm glad to answer any questions. We are supportive of the bill and the Dash 1 amendments.
Seeing no questions, thank you all three of you for working on the amendments too. That was for some of these are just a comment.
It's just a comment.
Sure. Yeah, Representative Winger. And then let me get Dan Goff and Tom Wolf and Lisa D. Brucker on their way up.
I don't have a problem with the bill as a reform effort. But based on the economic conditions in the state, I do have a problem with the fee. And I would really prefer to see the bill without the fee, either as separate or, ideally, like to see the department wait until the next election, next session, to bring back a fee increase so that we can go through the recession without raising fees on any economic activity that might occur in the state. I realize that means the department has to absorb the cost, but frankly, I prefer that over the people of Oregon.
Okay. Dan Goffin, Marion County Farm Bureau. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Klim. Dan Goffin, for the record, Marion County Farm Bureau, Beaver Creek Water Control President, Mill Creek Watershed Council President, Marion County Weed Board representative, and also president of Marion County Farm Bureau. The noxious weed issues for us on farms is very critical. There's a little weed called, I can't even think of the name, one brain dead. But anyway, it's a little round, about the size of a pea. It's got little thorns on it. If that is found in a green bean field, the cannery will probably bypass your field. You don't harvest it. I'm concerned about eradicating a whole field to get rid of the weed, but if that weed shows up in your field, you're not going to harvest it. I deal with hay, graze hay and grass seed. Everybody asks me, my hay got tansy in it, constantly spreading it. All over the country, birds carry it or whatever, I spray it. It's a constant battle. Unfortunately, the biggest propagator of tansy is the state highway system. Mm-hmm. And I know there's dollars, they can't do it, but somehow we've got to keep the weeds under control. So I'm very much in favor of this because the political issue, yeah, it's not nice, but the economic issue for farmers is devastating. I had a bent grass field years ago, get out there ready to swath it because bent is one of the latest varieties of grass seed. I see tansy in one corner. Where did this come from? So I cut it out separate, kept it in a separate lot, took to the seed cleaner, made sure it went into their record book to keep this separate. They cleaned the seed. It passed the test. That seed warehouse bought my seed, blended it with a whole bunch of other seed, retested it. Tansy showed up. And he was going to send me the bill for re-cleaning, retesting, rebagging. I says, where is that other lot of tansy possibly infested seed? They couldn't find it. Their help had run it in with the original lot. Luckily, I had been very specific, having it noted in their book to keep it separate. Otherwise, that would have cost me thousands and thousands of dollars. I thought I had the problem taken care of. These things sneak up on us. We don't know they're there sometimes. And so we've got to keep control of the weeds. And that's all I've got to say, but it's very important.
Why don't we just go ahead and finish the panel. Tom?
Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, representing our 3,000 members here in the state. One of the big concerns that many of our members have, they serve on watershed councils. They do a lot of projects in watersheds, and noxious weeds, eliminating noxious weeds in the riparian areas is a very large part of what they do. So we greatly support House Bill 2212 and its -1 amendments. We particularly like the fact that the Department of Agriculture worked very hard to meet many of the concerns of our environmental community. In particular, we like page 4, lines 34 through 36 insertions. We feel that this answers a lot of concerns that we have. This is just noxious weeds that invade our watersheds are a major, they do a lot of damage to riparian areas. They're as serving for 12 years on the Tualatin Watershed Council, 2 years as the chair, I can tell you that 30 to 35% of all we do in watershed councils is try to remove noxious weeds from riparian areas. It's a great problem, and this bill will help watershed councils and all groups that are working to eliminate noxious weeds from damaging riparian areas. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lisa Deborah Kerr. I'm the Oregon Invasive Species Council Coordinator. Our council was established by the Oregon Legislature in 2001, and we consist of government agencies, nonprofit organizations, academic institutions, and several other groups. In addition to that, we have an advisory committee of almost 35 groups that talk with us and make recommendations about the things that we do. Our job is to keep invasive species out of Oregon, and for those that do get here, to control, manage, or eliminate them. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today in support of House Bill 2212. On March 4th, the Oregon Invasive Species Council coordinated a meeting between the Oregon Toxics Alliance, Oregon Department of Agriculture, Oregon Conservation Network, the Nature Conservancy, to discuss the details of this bill and work out the proposed amendments that you see here today. And we believe that we had a productive meeting and that the outcome of that meeting is expressed in these amendments. So in its current form, this bill aligns with the mission and vision of the Oregon Invasive Species Council, and we very much support it. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for this panel? Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair,
there are times when natural methods can be used. I remember the flea beetle I put on my property for Tanzania. It did more in 6 months than I did in 20 years, literally, you know, with a backpack sprayer years ago. It just did it. And I think people need to understand that we don't go to chemicals first. And can you tell us a little bit of, I imagine you're very familiar with the rules. In other words, when you apply Garlon 4 and you're within a certain distance of a stream and about temperature and humidity and wind, the things that they have to look at before they apply it. I think people need to hear that.
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, I am not an expert in pesticide or chemical applications, so somebody else may have to address that here. But I can tell you that we use a suite of tools to deal with invasive species and rarely, if ever, go to chemical use as the first option. And we always try to look at what's friendly to the environment, what has the least effect on human health, and a variety of other factors before we go to chemical or pesticide application use. And it's, I think, the biggest thing that's important to our council is maintaining that robust suite of tools that we have to deal with invasive species.
Just one follow-up. Yeah,
please follow up.
My first tool are 17 grandkids with bags.
they love it.
I'm sure they do.
Okay, I'm going to release this panel. We've got one more witness, Lisa Arkin.
Thank you. Lisa Arkin, I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Toxics Alliance, and I want to thank you, Chair Clem, and members of the committee for allowing me to be here.
I have no phone.
Somebody has their phone on, Mr. Chair.
I know, we tried figuring it out. I'm not sure. So,
noxious weed.
I first of all want to thank the staff of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, in particular Dan Hilburn and also Lisa Debrecaire of the Oregon Invasive Species Council for convening the meeting in which we had a chance to look at this bill and work together with Ms. Petrino as well to hopefully offer you the Dash 1 amendments that will make this bill a stronger and better bill for our state. In particular, the bill has been revised to both eradicate and control noxious and invasive weeds while establishing simultaneously a rational criteria for a strong integrated vegetation and weed management program. And the characteristics of a sound integrated weed management program are in this bill comprehensive, and they take into account the type of weed, the level of threat, cooperation from landowners, the proximity to protected resources such as riparian zones, critical habitat, residential areas, and protection of the economic viability of our organic farms and forestry operations. And I want to draw attention to one of the Dash amendments that allow the Department of Agriculture to enter into mutual weed management plans with organic farmers, and that's very important because currently there are 933 organic farms in Oregon working on a total of over 92,000 acres and producing over $88 million in revenue for our state. So it's very important that those organic farmers have a way to control invasive weeds that meets their organic standards and that there isn't the hopefully never an opportunity where they might lose their organic certification from the misapplication of a pesticide. So we are very much in support of that amendment to the bill. We also want to draw attention to the 2008 study of our rivers by the United States Geological Survey, finding that there was pollution in the majority of Oregon rivers, including measurable levels of pesticides that were often above the standards for aquatic health established by the EPA. And so that, again, draws attention to our need to have a full range of opportunities that first prioritize non-chemical means of controlling invasive weeds before we move on to things that might indeed cause environmental harm. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Lisa? Representative Figueroa.
Not really a question, but I did notice on the earlier handout we had from Oregon Environmental Council or Invasive Species Council that the Oregon Department of Transportation was listed on here. And we heard testimony earlier about, and I had mentioned in a prior meeting of this committee, what I see along Highway 101, along the highway right-of-ways, there's no source that carries up and down around Oregon worse than our state highways. It's not only Tansy down where I am. You've got Scotch Bloom. We got Gorse and Coos and Curry County, and it's moving. And I don't see a lot of effort or investment. I know it's expensive, but something has to be done, and that agency needs to step up because it's only going to get worse. It's not going to get better.
Great. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you. I have a question for the department.
Okay, just one moment. I need to enter into the record and acknowledge a receipt of two letters, one from the city of Eugene and one from Jan Ronci of Blatchley, Oregon. And Representative Van Orman has a question of the department. Katie or Dan or both, maybe?
Yeah. Well, it's about the fee that Representative Wingard brought up.
So come on back.
Thank you, Chair Clem. And Representative Wingard, I would like you to talk to everybody who has raised my cost of living in my home, because everybody has raised their price. Anyway, on this fee, it says you may issue a temporary permit. You doesn't say you shall, but you may, which I read as saying that it's the department's choice about what you're going to do in terms of this fee.
You might just describe a rulemaking process and the public input that's allowed then as well, and your particular agency's rulemaking authority. You have director, not board.
Mr. Chair, in the Department of Agriculture, rulemaking authority rests in the chair of the director, not with the State Board of Agriculture. So if this was to stay in the bill, if we weren't, let's assume Representative Wingard's concern had not yet been raised. If this language was to stay in the bill, basically what it says is the department will set the fee, the actual fee for a temporary nursery license in rule. So we would go through a process of determining what our cost recovery amount was. Let's say it's $20, and we would go through a rulemaking process, your standard process, public hearing, comment, to set that fee. The question, I think, Representative Van Orman, that you asked is if we have a choice in terms of issuing a temporary license fee to a weekend sale. My understanding is if you're going to have a weekend sale, you have to get a temporary nursery license. I'm looking at Dan to see if that's correct.
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, that's correct. The reason why this exists, and you know, why is that, is to give the department the opportunity to ask the people putting on the sale, are you importing any plants from out of state? We really don't care if they're buying plants locally and selling them, but if they're importing plants, then we want to look at them to make sure they're healthy so they're not bringing in a problem. That's why the program exists.
Okay, and follow up?
Yes, please.
What is the incident? How often, how many permits a year do you give?
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Orman, it's several dozen a year. So we bring in a few hundred dollars now with this change, we're going to bring in a few hundred more. We estimated maybe $900 instead of a few hundred. So it's a very small amount of money that we're talking about. We could easily put off raising the fee for a couple of years if that would be the committee's wish.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I was going to offer a couple of things. If you want to take this language out, that's fine. I mean, we can come back in 2 years. It's not a problem. One of the other options would be to leave the language in. The cap is set at $50, but I would be willing to submit a letter to you to say the department would not raise the fee from $5 until following the 2011 session. I think it's really whatever your comfort level is, and we're fine with whatever the committee chooses to do. It's not a major part of the rewrite of the plan law.
We can talk about that in work session. Any more questions? Representative Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about how much revenue that the fee would bring in, I mean, has brought in and would bring in. Do you have an estimate of the cost to the agency to process these?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, we can certainly go back and get you a better number. Just off the top of my head, I'm going to say $25, but I'm not exactly sure, so I'm more than willing to come back with a number.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2212, open a work session on House Bill 2212. First thing that we need to do before we even discuss that issue is get the amendments in, I think.
Mr. Chair, is it your intention to pass this bill out today or to simply amend in the...
I'm going to discuss it after we get the other amendments in because I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, you want a motion for the dash one?
On the dash ones, please.
I move that we put dash one amendments on the House Bill 2212.
Representative Shoffler moves the dash one amendments on House Bill 2212. Any discussion on the dash ones?
Clarification.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clement. The dash ones are the ones that we received that says hand in gross?
They are. They're also separate, standalone, and they say dash one on them. Do they have those?
They do. It should be attached to your packet with the bill stapled together.
And that's just the dash ones then equal this that says hand in gross with them merged into the actual bill.
Okay. So as long as they're here, then I've got them because I don't think I have the other. Yeah. But that's okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Further conversation on the dash ones?
They moved to adopt the dash ones.
Okay, is there objection to the amendments?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to wait until we're talking about the bill to address the fee, but I'm happy to help the committee get the dash ones into the bill.
Okay. Seeing no objections, then the amendments are adopted. So...
Do you want a motion on the bill, Mr. Chair?
I kind of have to have one to even have a conversation, don't I? Yeah. Yes, please.
I move House Bill 2212 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation to and with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Rescinded. Thank you. Representative Shoffler moves House Bill 2212 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. So my personal opinion, but it doesn't have to be that of the committee, obviously, is I would take the letter from Director Koba stating, since it's her ability to make the rules and no one else's, saying I'm not going to make the rule during the 2009-11 biennium to raise the fee, versus having to spend whatever money it costs to have the drafters rework that, because I think it's got the same outcome. And it might be more than the whole fee brings in, frankly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I look at fees as an individual one. I'm not going to vote for every fee. I'm not going to vote against every fee. But this agency has a record with its constituents' base for 50 years. For me to just object to it because it's a fee increase isn't valid. It's a reasonable ask from us. I'm more than willing to vote for the bill as it is, and if the letter satisfies other people and that's okay at the department, that's fine too. But I'm more than willing to vote for the bill.
Okay, Representative.
Yeah.
I want to listen for a little bit of your comment.
I'll make my if you don't mind.
Yeah, please, Representative Winker.
My suggestion is to remove it from the bill, and here's why. I don't think it's integral to the bill. And I think you have a good bill, and I think you have an opportunity to get probably a unanimous vote, not only out of this committee, but probably on the House floor. I think because it's sort of extraneous to the bill, it's all the more reason to clear the path for it, to put the fee in at this point, it, based on the way the economic conditions are out there, I cannot support the bill, and I think you're going to lose some votes on the floor. Your bill's probably still going to pass, but I don't understand why, if we have an opportunity to create a unanimous situation and move the bill out, we wouldn't grab it when this element, this fee, is so not a major or significant part of what this bill is attempting to do.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. I appreciate and respect what the good representative said, but I just want to echo what my good friend from Gold Beach said, too. I mean, I've worked with this director for years, and if there's anybody in the building I can believe, it's her, and I don't say that lightly. And if she's not going to increase the fee, if she says here would be good enough for me, but in a letter too that she's not going to increase the fee, that she's not going to increase the fee. I do hope and pray in 2 years, if I'm able and willing and crazy enough to come back here and do this work, we may take a look at it then and see where we're at. But eventually, I think $5 ain't going to be enough to administer this stuff, even though it is a low-occurring request or application. So I completely and you know what? Some bills just don't get unanimous votes, and I have my experience with those coming out of business and labor, so I'm definitely going to support.
Let's talk about that a while.
Yes, I'm sure we'll.
Representative Gillen.
We'll be talking about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first, I am encouraged that Representative Shoffler hopes and prays. I think it's great to have that on the record.
Every damn day, Representative.
And without bringing the department back up, because we're actually in
work session, we can't. And then,
is it your understanding, Mr. Chair, that in addition to the fact that we have the word of the director, it isn't necessarily that the rule will, it raises the cap. It doesn't say that in every situation it will be $50.
It's my understanding that it raises the cap, and also that the director will write a letter that says, in this particular biennium, we won't even use the fact that the cap's been raised. So it's got the same practical effect of just not doing it at all, except that starting in 2011, they would be able to do it without legislative, unless she writes the letter again.
Right. And again, am I correct in understanding this? The fee that we're discussing relates to nonprofits holding these nursery sales, or is it a larger situation than that?
It's just the nonprofits, the garden.
And I meant to ask this, but I just didn't. I should have asked about what is that? How big of a number is that? I mean, what does that mean actually? But
The number was something around. I think it was several dozen.
Ask the good question.
Several dozen. Apply the difference if they, for example, which they're not going to this biennium, but if they were to raise the fee to like $20, it might be like $900 more total.
Well, with those assurances, I'm prepared to vote for the bill. It means a lot to me what the director said. It means a lot to me that Terry Witt comes in and supports this from the agriculture community. And the only thing I would caution the department is, when the folks from the department are testifying, I wish they would refrain from saying to Representative Shoffler, good question, because they don't say that to Krieger or myself. But other than that,
oh my goodness. Okay, further discussion. Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would support this bill with the letter or without the letter. I do think that it's a small amount of money, but it's money that is coming out of somebody else's fees or some other program to administer at this point in time. And I'm not sure that's quite fair. I think it should be at least self-supporting.
Representative Van Orman.
Well, thank you, Chair Clem. I must apologize to Representative Wingard, but I have been a little stressed lately because every bill that I have has gone up considerably. So I am cognizant of the increased cost of doing business at all levels, and I am not uncomfortable with the way it is written. I think, for me, it gives the department some flexibility, and I personally think that it's much more efficient than coming back all the time to the legislature to ask for something.
Well, I think what I would like to do is have the letter. It's certainly my belief that we will not change, obviously, per the letter. And the question just is then, taking more time to have the bill amended and LC go draft another language. I guess there's always an option on the Senate side on that front, too, if we felt we just had to have something besides the letter. But we only have 3 weeks left to schedule work sessions on bills, or else they're dead. And I really don't want to have another work session on this bill because I'm afraid of the large pile of bills we have waiting. So I'm going to support the bill, receive the letter. I'll carry it on the floor and comment on the letter on the floor, just that this is not an attempt to raise the fee now, and we'll have that on the record as well. And with that, I'd take any further discussion. If everybody's kind of said their piece, then I'll just... Clerk, we'll call the roll, please.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Wing.
No.
Vice Chair Van Orden.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krueger.
Aye.
Representative Shoffman.
Aye.
Representative Fielding.
Aye.
Representative Rowe.
Excuse.
Chair Flynn.
Aye. D. Motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the floor, and I will carry this. Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill. On my agenda. 2601. Dan, do you want to go ahead and come up? I'm just going to speak from here briefly. I introduced this bill at the request of Dan Goffin. He gave you a list of his involvement earlier. But I'm sure it could get a lot longer. And usually you're wearing many hats, or a hat that's rather colorful in character, but I know you wear many hats. My intent today is to understand... For all of our benefits, a little bit better how farmers get their fuel and what they do to transport fuel if they pick it up or have it delivered, and understand what the existing laws are around delivery and that kind of thing, and let Dan talk to us about how that works and what he would like to see done. And we're obviously, there's no work session, so this is just to gather information. And with that,
thank you, Chair Clem. I'm Dan Goffin. I'm farmer. I live here in Marion County. I talked to Representative Clem about this. The economy has forced agriculture to look for ways of saving money. I'm not a small hobby farmer. I own 170 acres, rent another 60, 70 acres in grass hay that I raise. And that's why the weed issue is very important to me. But the fuel issue, there's a couple of the larger farms around, they buy in full semi-loads. The discount is extremely great when you can buy in that volume. For us smaller ones, we don't have we could put in the tanks, but we don't want the fuel sitting around that long to use because it gets a fungus growing in it, plugs up your filters. With the new biofuel regulations, you don't want to round very long, especially the ethanol. They say that's got a 90-day window, then you better get rid of it. Burn it some way in your vehicle. But looking for a way that on small scale, as small operators, if we go to the co-op, the card lock, buy fuel, we're paying premium price. But if in the bill here, it has 10 agriculture. My original intent was to limit to 5. I want to keep this very small scale. So if we want to go with 10, that would be a different level where you have a little more regulation stuff. I want to keep this very small and very limited. So my suggestion would be a maximum of 5 that I've talked to a couple of the larger farmers, and they were willing to sell us fuel if we can work out the agreement. Right now, to do that, the larger farms has to have a dealer's license and go through all this red tape. And it's cost prohibitive for them to do it, just to help the neighbors. I want to keep it very, very limited. And if you wanted to cut it down less than five or two or something, that's fine. But I'm looking for a way that we can get our fuel a little more reasonable. My cattle, the feeders, are worth half of what they were 2 years ago. My feed has doubled. So if you put that round figures, it's worth about 25%. That's a little worse than the stock market right now. It's about 50%, at least the last time I looked, and I quit looking because it scares me. But I want a very limited scope so that we can at least have a better chance of buying fuel. Because on large volume to small, we can look at a dollar a gallon, almost. Because a few years ago, I was getting some from the neighbor farm and found out as an after thing that, they have to have a dealer's license and everything else, and they had to cease and desist. Well, okay, that's fine. But from the day that I was buying it to the next day I had to go to the co-op, 97 cents difference in price because they buy on volume, full tanker loads. And so that helps offset my lower income. But I want to keep it very, very minimal. But right now, with the new regulations that the taxing for fuel tax has come out with, the new forms that everybody has to fill out as effective the first of the year, they have to keep track of every gallon, every vehicle, and every mile traveled, even though the fuel tax is paid right up front. The federal government says you paid a fuel tax up front, we don't care. You don't have to list the vehicles. You don't have to list the miles or the gallons. The state is requiring to list every gallon burnt in each vehicle and every mile, even though the tax is paid up front when it is delivered. The paperwork is killing us. We have an economy, but I don't know if this bill would pass, whether we could even get anybody interested in doing it, the larger ones helping us, smaller ones out, because of the paperwork trail that we see coming down the road.
So, Dan, let me just ask you a question. On a practical level, how would this work? So someone with a full semi-capability would go down to the local co-op and fill up the way they do.
Well, they call the Wilco, Chevron, Union, whoever, say, yeah, hey, what's your price? They give them a quote. Okay, I want a full tanker load. They've got a big tank, 20,000-gallon tank or whatever. Some of them, they buy their whole fuel supply twice a year. But they would be delivered to their tank, and they all have meters on them, count the gallons out. And when I was getting it, I stuck it in my nurse tank in my pickup, counted the gallons, walked in, they took the meter reader off the total off the meter.
So
they looked at the price, and I paid them for it.
So you're not even talking about somebody going around and making deliveries to each farm. You're just talking about they go back to their own tank that's on the farm, and they've got their own dispenser. Like, we have it. We have our own tank.
Yes.
We have our own dispenser. Carson comes, they deliver it. And you want, essentially, me to be able to sell to the guy next door at exactly the cost I paid for it. The taxes were already paid on that whole load by me. When I had it delivered, that was factored into what Carson charged me, and you want the guy next door to be able to come over and use my pump and then pay me the exact same amount I paid
for it.
Well,
that part is negotiable between you and the person buying it. If they want to charge a penny more a gallon for it or whatever, we're still benefiting from it. Even if we go 10 cents a gallon, for them having to do the paperwork and have the pump and the facilities, that's fine. But if we're saving 90 cents and we take 10, we're still saving 80 cents a gallon. But the thing I'm having, they're having problems with, the new regulation from the state, that even though the fuel tax, this is highway vehicles, non-dyed diesel, the fuel tax is paid up front when it is delivered, it's included in the total bill. The federal tax is included in the total bill of fuel. The state is requiring everybody to keep every mileage, every vehicle, every gallon, everything separate. Dorfler Farms has 17 one-ton pickups, basically a little service rig that they run around the field. Amy's going nuts trying to keep track of it. If somebody forgets to write something down on the piece of paper, her hair's going to turn gray pretty quick.
Well, and this bill wouldn't help without
reform. No, but this is, my concern is that I, since you and I talked of how we could do this, this has come to light, and I'm not even sure if this would pass, anybody's even willing to do it anymore because of the farm. Because the federal, they're paid up front. They don't care. Why can't the state do it? And they've been called and asked, well, we're not on the level of state. And they said, well, why can't we even do it online? Well, we're not set up to do it. I think Oregon's getting a little bit behind the times. So my concern is, even if we pass this, we could work an agreement. I'm not sure anybody's interested in doing it with the paperwork would be involved.
Well, let me see if we have questions from the committee about what the, you know, sort of situation is. Mike, or Representative Schaffler.
Right. My question is, why is all this paperwork necessary? What do they do with all that data and stuff?
We don't have the department in here.
At this point, I do not have a clue.
Jeez.
That's a question that we can look into, though. Representative Krieger?
I'd like you to have someone from the department come in that deals with that record keeping and let us know the administrative rule, when it was adopted, so we understand what we're doing here.
Let me see if I got this right, Mr. Chair. If I'm a big grower and I got stuff going on, and Mike and I got crews out in the fields filling up my machinery, they have to log what they did with that fuel out. Every time they put the hose in the tank, they have to write down where, how many gallons, and where it went. Am I getting this right?
That is, Representative Schaffler, that is my understanding from talking to one of the large growers yesterday. They have to keep track of everything, and it's a paperwork nightmare. It's driving them crazy.
Mr. Chair, I grew up in an agricultural state, and I filled up a lot of rigs, and we never had to do anything like that ever. And I pray to God none of my pals back home. And Iowa, my home state, I should say, have to go through this. If I'm getting it right, it's absurd.
Yeah, let us look into it. I we have a pump in our place, and whenever I fill up a rig, we fill out on a clipboard, but it's not a government document. And what I have to figure out is if our foreman or something then transfers it over to a government document. But we do fill out, whether it's my car, whether it's, the old international, it doesn't matter. We have a clipboard, and we fill out what we put into each rig. And I thought it was just our record keeping, and my father-in-law thought I wasn't stealing gas from him.
that makes sense.
Well, I
have a question.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Dan, I do understand your price anxiety. I definitely understand that. And so I'm trying to understand the concept here, and what I'm sort of fixated on is the idea that you're trying to establish your own purchasing group so that you can get a price break. And then it sounds like there are distribution issues based on your ability to purchase as a group. Am I somewhat on track here?
Chair Clem, Rep. Van Orm, that is correct. We'd like very small scale that the neighbors could purchase our fuel from somebody that is set up, one of the other neighbors that is set up with a large scale that is willing to do it. They have the large tanks, they have the containment systems, they have all that stuff in place. But I want to keep it very small numbers. I don't want to open this up that Joe from Eastern Oregon could come over here and buy fuel. That's not my intent. I want to keep it very small. The bill says 10. I would recommend 5 max. Or even if you want to cut it down to less than that, but it's just so that us small ones can get a better break in the pricing of fuel. Because Wilco or any of them, they're not going to come out, and they can't afford to come out and give me the same price break on a large volume when they put 500 gallons of diesel in my tank.
Okay.
But this would give us a way of being able to another option of getting a little better discount, and it has to be agreement between all parties.
So let me walk you through something. I think you so you know where our orchard's right outside of Parkdale,
right?
And I think that the one gas station there was is gone.
Right.
And so when we go to get gas off the farm, I mean, it's a ways. It's down in Hood River. We go to Odell or go over to Jim's on. So we've got our own tank. And we
right.
find it more useful to have Carson just come in and fill
right.
it whenever it runs out.
Yeah, I understand
now,
that part.
So Ken Bailey, next door, he bought 80 acres. They don't have a tank on that piece. So I think the issue is, should Ken be able to come over and basically pay me without me having to become a full dealer and all the licenses
okay.
and
mm-hmm.
all the issues? And could you construct a fuel co-op that's tiny and is, you know, somehow allowed to not have to be a gasoline dealer or not? I mean, that's the policy issue of question, is what are the standards? Why do you need a license to be a dealer? And is it, you know, I mean, are there fees, public safety? Do you create an unlevel playing field? You know, if I get to do that for three or four neighboring farmers instead of them driving down to Hood River, you know, is that a huge problem we've created by allowing an exemption basically from it being a gasoline dealer? Or do you put in licensing requirements,
okay.
even on these guys? Okay. Representative Shoffler.
Yeah, you know, in Iowa they got these huge elevators and it says co-op on it. I wonder, and I think you can fill your truck up there at the co-op, and I wonder how they are they petroleum dealers, or do they purchase through a co-op process, or both?
Dealers.
I guess it's a question for
the dealers. Yeah,
there
they're
may
dealers.
Be both, but they may. I wonder if they get. I wonder if they provide their members with a cut rate, even though they have a dealer's license.
They can.
I mean, the issue is, though, you wouldn't drive your tractor all the way over to that place.
No, I understand.
Yeah, it's having it right there on the farm.
And they deliver, too. I don't know what's
yeah.
going on.
Yeah. So, any other questions? I mean, obviously, we have to do more work and talk about this in our offices and see, you know, if we can come up with anything and work with the dealers on, you know, what that would mean and that kind of stuff. But maybe? Representative Byer?
Yeah. Sorry. Mr. Chair, yeah. we do have someone in the audience that has some knowledge about the business, and maybe he didn't sign up, but
didn't sign up.
He might be able to shed a little light on some of this.
If so desired, Paul, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Petroleum Association, and welcome to the whole fuel distribution issue in the state of Oregon. You have just gone into the quicksand, and I hope somebody sends you a rope at some point here in the near future. The problem with fuel distribution is that the various things that we've been doing, regulations, everything else, have basically been putting a crimp on fuel distribution in the rural areas. You're losing your retail stations. We have a policy in this state of no self-service, which basically means that you have very high labor costs, and if you don't have a lot of volume, it's very difficult to make a station go. We have a basically what this is a whole card lock issue. And there's another bill that came out of the Senate which actually lowers the card lock threshold now down to 500 gallons per year rather than the 900 gallons per year. That should be coming to one of your committees at some point here in the near future. The problem is that it is unfair competition if you allow, in effect, in special circumstances, somebody to become a dealer for five people. I mean, you're basically saying the system's broken, but we're going to fix it over here for five people. You sort of have to look at the whole thing. They have a legit problem of how to get fuel. It's a very difficult situation, but it's all over rural Oregon. There is the access to fuel is becoming more and more difficult with more and more restrictions put on folks. So this problem is not just how to set up a fuel cooperative. It's much bigger than that.
Representative Shoffler.
Not to be argumentative with our good friend Mr. Romaine, but in states where there is self-serve, I don't think the fuel necessarily is any less expensive than it is in Oregon. Just wanted to clarify that little tidbit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, without being argumentative on this, you sound like my wife, actually.
Thank you.
There is debate over the cost of fuel and that which goes into the cost of fuel, and the Oregon Petroleum Association is not taking a stand on self-service. We just point out that in certain areas it becomes very difficult to have a station, basically, because you don't pump enough gas to really justify the costs, various cost factors, and labor happens to be a big cost factor. Doesn't mean you should get rid of it. In fact, we are schizophrenic about that issue. Some of my folks like it. Mm-hmm. Some of the folks don't. So we're not advocating, but it is one of the issues out there, and there's a lot of factors that go into the cost of your retail gasoline.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. One of the questions I have, you mentioned more regulation, more requirements. Are we talking about state and federal, federal alone, state alone?
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, it's sort of both. I mean, most recently, DEQ just passed some underground storage tank or fill regulations, stage one vapor recovery, if you would. In effect, you have to put in some very expensive stuff to make sure there's no vapor release. They were kind enough after a lot of testimony to raise the threshold up because it would have closed a ton of stations out in rural parts of Oregon, but it still wasn't raised up to the federal level. Oregon happens to be, the federal reg came in and said every station that's 100,000 gallons per month or more has to have particular equipment. Oregon was one of, I think, one or two states that actually dropped that down to 40,000 gallons or more. So you have a number of those more rural stations between 40 and 100,000 gallons that basically have these very expensive things they have to do to keep the station open. That's one of the examples that we face. There may be legit reasons for that, but again, you have to understand it's balancing the economics of it versus the environmental benefit. There may be enough environmental benefit to have the economic regulation, but every time you put a cost factor onto somebody, you are saying it's more expensive to have that station, and and that's also why you end up with the smaller stations having to charge so much more, because if you're in an area that has a lot of traffic, like in your area, the Biggs Junction, that's the cheapest gas because you got a lot of traffic coming down. You go just a little bit away from there, and the gas is far more expensive because they're not making as much per gallon. Or they can't sell it as many gallons. They have to make more per gallon, sorry.
So let me ask a question. Is it your understanding that you own the tank and the dispenser and you want to fill up your own stuff? You don't need to be a dealer because you're not selling it. You're just filling up your own stuff.
Correct.
And do you think it's definitely in conflict with current law that if the guy next door comes over and gets filled up by you and you don't charge him anything other than the actual cost, that is not lawful?
Chair Clem, I believe if you're acting as a dealer, which is you're selling it to somebody else, then you need a dealer's license. But
I think at one point we thought about the splitting it up after the purpose right. was allowed already under existing law. I don't think that's the case. I think the guy next door literally cannot come over and do it until I get licensed.
Right.
And that's the way we've been operating. Nobody comes and gets our gas. But the question is, really, There are no service stations within 10 miles of Parkdale, mm-hmm. and so everyone needs to put in their own dispensary and their own deal on every single farm in order to not have to drive or get a, I don't know exactly what you would do otherwise. I mean, you'd have to drive every tractor 10 miles down the road in traffic on Highway 35 to get to the nearest gas station. Or put in your own dispensary, which is what most of us done. I mean, ours still says 35 cents a gallon on it. That's how old it is.
I'll be right up.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I'll even pump my own.
Chair Clem, if I could One of the things that we've at least kicked around is the possibility of doing some maybe creative things in rural Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some of the things that would apply in urban Oregon really should be somewhat relaxed. And again, without getting argumentative, there is a possibility that maybe when you're in a sparsely populated area that having a self-service situation
yes.
makes a lot of sense, whereas when you're in an urban situation, it doesn't make as much sense. The labor benefits and everything else offset it. It may be that it's better to allow something like that, and again, it's subject to discussion, and again, without being argumentative, we could talk about that.
Representative Gilliam.
So, Chair, if Mr. Bailey comes over
mm-hmm.
and says, can you help me out, I get this pickup, fill it up, and you do that, if you don't record it because you were the original receiver of that tank of fuel, are you in violation of the law?
I'm already in violation because I'm not a dealer.
So you're not just, nobody...
If I gave it to him for free, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, if I gave it to him for free, I think that's fine because I'm not selling anything.
But if it's a wink-wink, I'll buy you a case of beer later, you got a problem.
And I'd need to record it, it sounds like, even if it were on my own place. Well, we need to nail down on your own place for your own stuff. But it sounds like I might have to record it. And, yeah, if I somehow got compensated. And, I think that's the fundamental question about if you sell it at literally cost, nonprofit, is that still in violation of the law or not? Is it only when you start marking it up that's a problem, or is it even just taking any compensation?
Because you'd still have to do the paperwork, according to Mr. Goffin, you'd still have to do the paperwork. Because you have to account for where the gas went. So if it went to Bailey's truck or your own tractor, you've got to...
If it's true that you got to do the paperwork, yeah, because you got to make sure the taxes got paid. Although they're paid when Carson delivers it to us. We pay them, and they...
So I'm just wondering if... Yep. Let me ask the...
Chair Clem, the problem is that with... You're talking about a car lock facility, and you can only put it into certain vehicles, and those vehicles have to be used in business. It can't just be pleasure vehicles that you put stuff from card lock into. So next time you see a Mercedes filling up at a card lock, you might want to take down the name.
Well, and ours isn't even card lock. You flip the handle and you start pumping. There's no nothing. And
we're
people could go out
there.
And now I'm advertising people to come steal my...
That's a problem.
Yeah.
35, you go
have
Highway
a lot
35
of,
and then
yeah.
which way do you...
Guess what? There's a lot of guns and two Rottweilers in there, too. Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Romaine, I know you're being very cooperative, and we appreciate that. If we strip away the very complicated part of this and the regulation and all, if you get to the essence and the intent of this bill, what would be the objections from your industry standpoint to a 3-person fuel co-op, a 5-person, any that you can see?
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, we're not sure we have objections to anything. We're just trying to point out that this is not an individual problem. We want folks to be able to buy fuel at a reasonable price, but there also has to be kind of that level playing field. I want to do it for this or that special circumstances. Well, you're competing against somebody who has to get the permit. Now, are there circumstances where you might want to change the rules, bend them, whatever? Without getting argumentative, we could look at anything.
So follow up.
And he didn't sign up to testify. We roped him up here just to be fair.
Well, that's the part I enjoyed.
That's why I was so kind to him, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
But the follow-up is just simply, intent-wise, you're okay. We've got a lot of other ground to cover, but intent-wise, you're okay.
That was a nod for the record.
Yeah, okay.
Briefly, Mr. Chair, we beat this to death. I know in growing up, neighbors work together all the time. And if you're running low, there's just a gentleman's agreement. And if you're out in God's country in Oregon, way out in Burns, you got thousands of acres. I'm sure we're probably making scoff laws out of good people because they just do business among one another. Nothing wrong with it, nothing dangerous, not against the environment or any ethics or morality. But I'm sure that it goes on right now, and God bless them for doing it. The more I listen to this, the more I sympathize with you. So I don't know. It's I'm sure neighbors work. I know for a fact they do. They do where I grew up. So maybe we work something out.
That's a Representative Krieger.
It's not unique to this.
Oh no.
You see full tankers come down to Brookings Dock and they'll put 10,000 in one of those big commercial fish boats and 11 out of the back tank into another boat. Two of them take the whole load to do the same thing that you're trying to do. So if they have it delivered, you know.
Okay. Anything else before we close this public hearing? Dan, final thoughts? We'll work on what we can do, if anything.
Thank you, Chair Clem. It was just something I've, you know, myself and neighbors been trying to figure out a way to cut production costs. Because but agriculture is the one entity that we don't quit when the economy goes to hell. The timber people, they have to cut back. The mills shut down. They lay off people. No matter what the economy does, ag still plugs along. We may lose our shirt, our socks, and every few other things in the process for a few years, but we don't quit. We're the only industry in Oregon, and I don't consider government industry, that keeps going no matter what it is until we're broke and the bank comes knocking on the door and hangs a lock on it. But ag keeps going. But right now in the economy, we have to look for ways to survive. The big operators have advantages over us, and some of them are willing to work with us, and that's what I was trying to establish.
Well, I think you'll note that the committee name is Ag Natural Resources, and the chair of this committee helped with the vice chair here, helped make law a estate tax provision that lots of other people believe they're entitled to, but it only applies to ag and natural resources. So it's not like we're immune to the possibility of special support for these industries, but we're going to have to work on this one a little bit further. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2601 and adjourn the committee. Thanks.